good to be home for my very first Father's Day. The Liturgy of the Word this afternoon presents us again with more readings about agriculture, something most of us no longer know anything about in our little piece of concrete heaven. But the farther you travel south and west from here, maybe on Schlapp or Grove or Reservation Road, the less concrete you see. And within 5 minutes, you're surrounded again by farmland. I have no idea who the farmers are, how the fields get planted, plowed, or harvested. One day it seems there's nothing, and then the next day the corn is taller than my car, and then the next day it's empty again. And today Mark reminds us that Jesus spoke to his disciples about this exact phenomenon. This is how it is with the kingdom of God. It is if a man were to scatter seed on the land and would sleep and rise night and day, and through it all the seed would sprout and grow. He knows not how. Of its own accord the land yields fruit. First the blade, then the ear, then the full grain in the ear. And when the grain is ripe, he wields the sickle, for the harvest has come. Of course, as any farmers among us will tell you, this parable is not exactly the most realistic, because only in heaven would a piece of farmland simply need to be seeded and allowing the farmer to sleep and rise, and the next thing he knows, it's ready for harvest. He knows exactly how it sprouts and grows, and sometimes he wonders whether the crops grow more by the rain or by the sweat from his brow. He is the father of that farmland, and it's up to him to make sure that it grows. Many of you, too, are fathers of little seedlings or of big grown-up crops, and you know well that there is more to fatherhood than simply planting, sleeping, and rising. I, too, am a father. I, too, am responsible for the growth and well-being of the children entrusted to me, namely all of you. And to make sure that you thrive, not only in this life, but that by your thriving in this life, you might live in the fullness of your Christian discipleship and begin to see beyond the passing things of this world and deep into eternity, deep into all that is being offered to you. And this too requires much more than planting, sleeping, and rising. Anybody who has watched the news or has crawled out from their rock this week knows that I could simply open up a page of the newspaper and put my finger down and name some controversial topic to preach about. Shall I talk about immigration today? Should I talk about tariffs with China today? Should I talk about any number of government corruption today? It was bound to be a weekend with a tough homily. And I would like to preach on something difficult today, something that is going to hit close to home tomorrow, and I just ask that you would give me a little chance. Okay? All right. Many have been asking me about the inaugural Gay Pride Parade tomorrow in Aurora. Is it a sin if I go? They say. How can they allow something like this? Well, I think it's a wonderful opportunity. I just don't understand. And I know that the issue of homosexuality is not an easy one for many people. Many in this church today have family members or friends who experience same-sex attraction. I have friends and many people in my life who experience this, or who themselves might identify as gay. Please know that all, and I do mean all, are welcome here. I know also that there are those in this church, perhaps some here this evening, who feel that the church should be more accepting to men and women who experience same-sex attraction. There are those in the church, perhaps some here this evening, who feel that the church has not done enough to fight for the sanctity of marriage. Please know that all, and I do mean all, are welcome here. This topic is a highly polemical issue, but for the Christian, the topic is not ultimately polemical, Because remember, the church's stance is never polemics, but always Christ. Too often our discipleship, our living of life according to the fact of Jesus Christ, is reduced to a kind of social work, as if the greatest thing that the church had to offer the world was social justice. And so our ministry is reduced to simply being good people, or helping the needy, or standing up for what we believe. Which, none of that's bad in itself, of course. But the danger is that all of our life with Christ becomes built on the values that Christ taught us. And so all of our efforts at charity or cultural or social or political activity, while they have as their aim the betterment of society, they're built on values that Christ taught us and not on Christ himself. We do things because they're good things to do, but not because we are disciples. Atheists have charities. Atheists do good work. Non-Christians do good work. So what is it about our discipleship that makes it quantitatively and qualitatively different? Do you consider yourself to be a disciple? Do you remember the beginning of your journey as a disciple, when you knew that it was more than just values and actions, but a life and a relationship with a person? Do you have a recollection of the moment in your personal history when you knew the fact of Christ, when you heard his voice and he filled you with courage to turn around and to follow him? When I finally gave in to the call to become a priest in Christmas Eve in 2010, it was not because I was convinced by words in a book about Jesus, or by the desire to serve the poor, or hear confessions, or celebrate Mass. It wasn't values that convinced me, but it was a person who called me. I fell victim to a certain enthusiasm for a presence. And for me, the persuasive motive was the very fact of Jesus. That it is in knowing him, and only in knowing him, that gives life and meaning and creativity to my ministry and to my life as a Christian disciple and witness. But if we remove the person of Jesus from our discussions of issues like homosexuality or immigration or the economy or divorce and remarriage, and we speak to one another from merely political points of view, then we lose the joy that's brought to us by Jesus. And so gladness does not appear on our faces, and our efforts to lead people into joy toward the wonders of discipleship, they lose their authenticity and credibility. We are supposed to be a resurrected people, a people who has come back to life. But if no joy appears on our faces and we communicate merely from the point of view of the world, then our witness fails like bad seeds in good soil. So no matter what you find yourself doing or what situation you might encounter or who's saying what to you, remember that standing in front of me at all times is a fellow human being, a daughter or a son of God. And in those moments that occur in real time, the one option, which for the Christian disciple is always, without exception, without negotiation, the one option that is always off the table in our relationship with other people as Christians, is abandonment, discrimination, judgment, or pushing away. That might be the way of the world. It might be the way of politics. But we are Christians now. We belong to something, to someone whose perspective is wider, whose point of view is broader, and whose heart is bigger than ours will ever be without him. There are those on one side of the argument who say that freedom is the most important. Freedom of religion, freedom from sin, freedom from being exposed to the life of others, freedom from the glorification of sin. And there is some truth there. We can't condone the sin, but what about the sinner? So there are those on the other side of the argument who say that freedom is the most important. Freedom to be oneself, freedom to express oneself as he or she desires, freedom to live for others and the life that they want. And there is some truth there. We can't condone the sin, but what about the sinner? And then there is the church's way, the way of Christ, a third way, which says that freedom is the most important. Freedom, in the most Christian sense, is the ability to be myself according to reality. It's not to say, I have no sin, I am perfect, my life is fine, everything's figured out, and now I'm free. But freedom in the Christian sense is to say, I got a lot of issues. I got some stuff going on in me. I'm working through some things. But that's true. And I'm bringing it all to this place. I'm bringing it all to Him. I'm bringing it all and laying it down. I'm bringing the fullness of myself, of all that I experience, to God. I am able to be myself, not pretending like I'm perfect, but being myself according to reality. And so many get lost in the arguments about what the law should or shouldn't say, whether God made gay people that way or not, or is it the result of nurture and psychology? But the church is asking a different question. The church is asking, in the midst of this experience, in the midst of these struggles, how can my life be lived well? Some say that this is not an issue at all for the church, but only for the sciences, for biology to find the gene, and for psychology to find whatever it can find. But insofar as this issue concerns the human person, especially a deep, tender area of the human person like sexuality, it is an issue for the church, because it is an issue for one of God's children. So, to all of our gay brothers and sisters, let me say this. You are loved. You are alive. What you are feeling is real. And I am sorry if you have felt alienated by my actions or of actions in this community. Because you too are beloved. But you too are called to discipleship. What you are experiencing and the way that the church will help you live it is, and I am convinced of this, a catalyst for holiness. That the pain and the loneliness and the shame and the confusion will not last forever. Each one of us, priest or deacon or monk or nun or married or single or old or young, tall or short, smart or not so smart, straight, gay, Cubs, Sox, Pepsi, Coke, all of us are called to be holy and free. To be more interested in the will of God for us than in a few short moments of temporal pleasure. Sin is sin, period. And what we believe about sexuality and specifically about the marital act, we don't believe it because the church is some mean old hag who wants to steal my joy. We believe it because we believe that God has made us, every part of us, to aid in the coming forth of His kingdom. Everybody is called to holy chastity, to refraining from certain acts with certain people who are not their spouse, and from those acts which do not bring forth life. But this, like so many areas of pain and of consternation and of confusion that plague the lives of everybody, these areas will be transformed by the power of the Spirit of God into something beyond our wildest imagining. But it requires more than planting and sleeping and rising. Friends, we must be vigilant of each other. We must become modes of support for each other, brothers and sisters for each other, as Christ has been to us. Because something great is being promised to us. Something beautiful shall sprout up in our fields because we have indeed been given the grace to live this way. So I'm not asking that you be convinced of everything that I say when you leave here today, but only that you might give what I say a chance. That the happiness, the fulfillment, the community, the affirmation, the beauty, the recognition, the companionship, the peace for which we all are seeking can really be found in the living and risen Jesus who lives among us. and who we have come to receive from that altar. And all the trees of the field shall know that I, the Lord, bring low the high tree, lift high the lowly tree, wither up the green tree, and make the withered tree bloom. As I, the Lord, have spoken, so will I do. Amen.